morning, all. Calling the meeting to order. We don't yet have an agenda. I expect that. Yes, we do. We have an agenda. A quorum, I mean. We have a. What we really have in is an agenda. So, let me just tell you about the what's I see coming up here. We have a long agenda for today. It shouldn't take that long, though, is my guess. We have room for tonight, and in case, we have a room for tomorrow. And I say in case, I would prefer not to meet tomorrow, but if we are in the floor today for a long time for any reason, I do have to continue this hearing until tomorrow to get all of the work done. For this bill. Two of the bills here we do not yet have in possession. They are in other committees, but I expect them here. So we will do informational hearings on them. And one of those is Representative Hornstein's, and one of them is Representative Hansen's. Representative McMurphy, go ahead.
Just, Madam Chair, did you say we will be coming back tonight for sure to process those two bills after the floor, or we won't need to come back for those two bills?
Well, the way we're going to go is there will be a delete all an amendment to one of my bills on the agenda today, which is going to be our vehicle, and that's why you see those bills on the agenda. And we will have an amendment... an author's bill posted, I was hoping, by tomorrow night, but I'm not sure that's going to happen because I can't tell how much floor time we're going to have. But to make sure that folks have enough time to amend the bill I put on the table, our omnibus bill, we will certainly have it posted this weekend. And we will say you can have amendments up until Monday evening at 6 o'clock because we won't be voting on the bill until Tuesday evening, I'm sure. We'll go over it in the morning and then have a vote on it in the evening. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what would you say if we make assumption floor runs late? What would you say the latest you'll post your bill this weekend? What would be the latest that folks would see it?
Oh, I'm hoping Saturday. I don't believe in Sunday work. So,
but Sunday, pardon me, Madam Chair.
I don't want anybody to work on Sunday. But if we post it on Saturday, you'll still have all day on Monday to write amendments, is what I'm... that's easiest on staff, too.
Okay. Thank you.
Does that make sense? Well, it may not make. You don't have to say whether it makes sense or not, but that is what we're doing. That is going to be, we could, if we were really efficient, get through almost all of this today, except for getting through to Hansen's bill. That still has it. Well, won't be ready. So I just want to tell you one thing I'm going to send around to you today. As I was driving in this morning, there was a long report on water in southeast Minnesota. And they're having their ground level series on groundwater. So with that, we're going to welcome Representative Hornstein. We have had several visits about recycling, this bill is not yet in our possession, but has been heard and passed through the Environment Committee, and will be, I assume, in our possession tonight. So, with that, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I really appreciate your taking the time to have an informational hearing on House File 2564. This legislation comes out of a couple of important developments that have taken place in the last...
Can I just... What's being handed, so just so you know, your bill is in the packet, and what's being handed out was the amendment that was adopted last night.
Okay.
So people have the bill in order that it will come to us later on today.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, thanks to the committee for hearing this bill today. This legislation has come out of a couple of important developments that have taken place in the field of recycling and organics composting over the last several years. Primarily, the fact that the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board in the metro area, which consists of six of the seven metro counties, and the Pollution Control Agency have both adopted a increased recycling and composting standard for the metropolitan region. A goal, actually. It's not a standard in law, although that's one of the provisions of the bill to codify it. And that is a 75% recycling rate for the metropolitan region, or those six counties. And 60% of that would be through traditional recycling, and then the additional 15% comes from organics composting. And I'm especially excited about the potential for organics composting. When the Pollution Control Agency released its recent waste characterization study, where they updated the composition of the waste stream as they have studied it, 31% of that waste stream consisted of organics. That is primarily food waste, but it also consists of non-recyclable paper products, such as napkins, paper plates, soiled pizza boxes, etc. And the fact of the matter is we have to be responsive to this pretty significant development in terms of the composition of the waste stream. And simultaneous to that, we've seen some projects that have taken place in local communities, including in my own district, where we have neighborhoods that are now collecting separate or this waste stream, this organics waste stream, they're collecting it separately at the curbside. And so we have, for example, in my district, in my neighborhood even, the opportunity for us to send our composting to a facility, I believe in Rosemont, Minnesota, where it's very safely composted, a high quality compost that's used in a variety of agricultural and transportation projects around the state. And so I believe this organics composting is almost like recycling was in the early 70s. There was huge public interest and public acceptance. The environmental and economic benefits were very, very clear to people. And our businesses and our communities really wanted that opportunity to engage in recycling and do it as efficiently and quickly as possible. So we had centralized recycling facilities. Where I grew up in Ohio, you had to take your recyclables to a place by the University of Cincinnati, and people did that. But then, of course, that evolved into curbside programs, which are, of course, very popular and widely used around the country. And so now we're looking at the potential to really move composting forward in the same way we moved recycling forward in the 70s, by giving people opportunities to compost at the curbside. We have a couple of other provisions in addition to the recycling goals that are policy-oriented. One is making sure that certain classes of businesses are providing more opportunities to recycle and compost, and so we have the provisions around commercial buildings and stadiums. And then the funding piece, which is, I think, of particular importance to this committee, is the fact that we have grants that counties administer to promote recycling and organics composting through the SCORE program, the Select Committee on Recycling and Environment. This dates back to around 1990, I believe 1990, when then-Governor Rudy Perpich had a task force on recycling, and that task force came up with statewide recycling goals, which we're updating. And I want to emphasize again that we're updating the metro goals only. Even though the SCORE money that we are increasing through this bill is statewide in nature. So we're not asking Greater Minnesota at this point to increase the recycling goals, but the additional funds that are available in this bill will be distributed statewide. What we do in the funding piece, which is very important, is that original SCORE money set up through a tax on solid waste was meant to go specifically for recycling purposes. Unfortunately, somewhere down the line, and I still don't know exactly where this happened and when it happened, someone told me it was during the Carlson administration, but who knows? We've had so many examples of funds going for a specific purpose that are then diverted to the general fund. This is an example of funds that were raised for a specific purpose going to the general fund. So in order to reach these higher recycling goals, we're saying to the counties, we're going to give you more resources to do that by making sure that the SCORE money goes for its intended purpose. So that's the finance part of this bill. I'll say in conclusion, Madam Chair, that I want to make sure that when we are dispersing this money out to the counties, that we have something in our legislation, and I'll work on that here, I believe, in the next 12 hours, that ensures that we're going to have a specific grant program for organics composting. I think that's a really, really important part of this legislation, and that we are able to have some criteria and standards in order to disperse this money. So, we're trying to reach a specific goal that, again, has been established through a stakeholder process by both the Metro Counties and the PCA, and we want to codify that. We know that when we've dealt with this in the energy arena, having a specific goal in statute has really helped get us there and promote the businesses that are responsible for getting us there. So this is great legislation both for the environment and the economy, and I think we're going to hear testimony about the job creation potential as well as the environmental benefits of increasing recycling and composting. And with that, Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Questions for the author at this point? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative, thanks for your effort to get more SCORE funding to where it goes, should go. Any place in your bill does it change the method of how those funds are distributed in greater Minnesota? Anything in your bill that addresses different methods of distribution?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate that question, Representative, because, in fact, the amendment that was passed out, one of the amendments that we adopted in Representative Chair Dill's committee yesterday dealt with some modifications of the formula so that there will be a little bit more funding going to greater Minnesota through that. Hennepin County was working on that with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I believe they came up with a mutually agreeable formula on that.
Representative Ferguson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, thank you for bringing this forward. My question relates to how this, works differently in greater Minnesota compared to the metro area. You know, things are pretty dense up here, and routing trucks around and that sort of thing is pretty easily accomplished. When you get out to greater Minnesota, where things are much more spread out, I'm wondering if this is going to work as well for us.
Thank you very much for that question, Representative Torkelson, Madam Chair. That is one of the reasons why, and I think that there's some consternation about this among some recycling advocates, and I had mixed feelings about doing this as well, but that is one of the reasons why we are not asking Greater Minnesota at this time to increase their recycling goal. So the recycling goal envisioned in this bill relates to the metro counties. So I hope that through getting some additional resources to greater Minnesota in this bill, there'll be ways in which we can creatively increase recycling opportunities in less dense areas. But at this point, we are not asking greater Minnesota to increase their recycling goals.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We have some in Redwood County, for instance, we have some of the highest recycling rates in the state. But it's the organics piece of this that is more concerning. Organics don't keep very well. And it's a challenge to send them through a system rather than just recycle them on your own facilities, or site, I should say.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I appreciate that challenge. And again, as I hope that we're moving as a state together, perhaps with the better infrastructure for organics composting in the metropolitan area, although Hutchinson has been way ahead. I think the city of Hutchinson, Minnesota, has been doing this with very high participation rates, even before my Minneapolis neighborhood or St. Louis Park adopted curbside composting. So I think there's actually the opportunity for organics composting has existed in greater Minnesota longer than in the metro if you look at the city of Hutchinson. So we were going to use that as a model. But you have a point well taken, and I hope that as this bill progresses and as it's adopted, we can move together as a state to promote this.
Representative Hornstein, you've been talking about curbside recycling of composting, but for some folks in greater Minnesota, would one of the opportunities be to provide, say a county were to do bulk buying of composting bins for individual households, would that be a possibility?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly agree with you and believe that should be a part of this, and I think the nice thing about the way the SCORE program is set up by the PCA is that it is statewide in nature, and the idea of having a grant program means that perhaps a greater Minnesota county or a more rural county can set up a proposal so that then they can use this money funneled through the county then to their, however they would want to disperse it, to schools, to local governments, to others, businesses, to do exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about. So that's how this is set up, and that's why I think the SCORE program works well as a PCA pass-through to the counties.
Okay, did you have a question about that?
Yes, it relates to this whole issue. There's a piece in here about building inspections. I'm just curious about how you intend to enforce that, how we will get the manpower out there to do the inspections, and what kind of penalties there might be if we're non-compliance.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I believe that laws are the best incentive for people to do what's the right thing to do that we envision in this. I don't see a huge inspection or enforcement regimen that's necessary. We know that given the opportunity to recycle, compost, have bins, have the resources to do that, businesses will do what's needed and required. We had wonderful testimony in the Environmental Policy Committee yesterday from the River Center, the Minnesota Wild, and how they were able to, through really a minimal amount of resources on their own initiative, significantly increase their recycling and composting, but what's most important, save $50,000 a year in doing so. We heard about the WasteWise program that the Chamber of Commerce is involved with. So, there's a lot of activity going on with businesses already. I think they will continue to trend in that direction. I think this having this codified will certainly move people in the right direction. And so I don't see a lot of resources needed. But, just enough to make sure that people know that this is the law.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. There is some concern in our communities that more regulation, more potential for penalties and garbage cops is a concern. We feel we're doing pretty good work now, and spending state assets on this maybe not be appropriate.
Okay, Representative Hill. One thing I think we should comment, and I just... this bill has in it fully taking the SCORE money out of the general fund. Well, that money is actually more than our target, so that's not possible. As we go forward, there will have to be an adjustment to the financial side of this bill, too. So we will...
And just I wanted to very quickly respond to one comment Representative Torkelson made. And, we do pretty well in Minnesota, but our, when we look at other states, not maybe as great as we think we do. What unfortunate part of our recycling, the data about recycling in the state is it's remained pretty flat over the last 20 years. And so, you know, we really need to increase and improve our performance on this. And I think that's part of the reason why we're, you know, not only looking at our goals, you know, having them increase, but most importantly, giving, you know, counties and other stakeholders the resources they need to get to those goals.
Representative Hamilton's next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hornstein. You know, I remember go back you know, 20 years, and at the curbside pickup, they made you sort them, right? And I remember getting nasty notes when my cans were mixed up with my bottles or whatever, and then I thought, I'll teach you, I'll just throw everything in the trash, right? And then it came single sort at the curbside, which is great, and now we actually have a little compost area that we built in the backyard where you can throw some of that the organic stuff. But how close are we just to having a single drop, picking it up and sorting in one area to where, again, just keeping it simple for the individuals and the residents?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, that is exactly the trend. Minneapolis, we just started this about 6 months ago, or within the year, I know that. And our recycling rate has increased dramatically as a result. So I think if you make it convenient and straightforward for the public and for businesses, they will recycle. This is a very popular thing, and people know that this is one of the things they can do that's probably the, you know, both for their pocketbook and for the environment, very practical. So I think that's the trend towards single stream. I think it increases recycling rates, and you know, we're moving in that direction. And one of the things that I want to accomplish with this legislation is to make sure that organics composting, either through the way you do it or in your backyard or the way I do it, which is at the curbside, that those opportunities are available for people and that they can significantly reduce what they're sending to a landfill or an incinerator by simply composting that waste. And it's safer to do that, and we really avert a lot of methane and greenhouse gas emissions by doing that.
Okay, Representative McNamara, I believe you are next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, first I'd like to follow up on Representative Hamilton's question. Today in our single sort, we, with our plastic bags, you kind of, they ask you to bunch them together, at least my carrier does. You bunch the plastic bags together, wrap them up, and you throw them in the single sort. Wouldn't we potentially be able to do the same with the organics, too, put them in a container of some sort in the single sort? I think to follow up, Representative Hamilton, it seems like the industry is going more and more into moving this stuff to sorting facilities where it actually will catch everything, as opposed to the current plan to regulate our way to it. Isn't that a possibility where then people would be able to not have to store the organic separately, but would be able to put them in some kind of a container, put them in the single sort? Because doesn't the single sort material go to a sorting facility?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative McNamara. I will defer. We're going to have a few experts, a little more expert than me on that process, testify. So I'll defer to them. But I think I think there would be some challenges doing that. I'm not aware of a community that puts the organics with the recycling, because we handle that in a different way, because you know there's a composting process that has to take place, rather than, you know, when you have the you know, the recyclables, those are, as you mentioned, I think mechanically sorted, and you know, the bottles go one place, the paper goes another. I think that there would be some challenges doing that with the organics. And you have a wonderful facility in Dakota County where I think a lot of our organics in the region go to, and I think to keep that separate and haul it there separate is probably the most practical way to do it at this point.
Okay, one more question. I think if we're going to get some answers to these questions from the testifiers, too, and you'll have another opportunity, but go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, I just want to bring, we mentioned it last night in policy, on line 1.16 of your bill, it lists containers, and I think potentially that should say container or containers, so I hope you'll work on that issue. I do have a question. I thought about it last night on my way home. I thought about, in rural Minnesota, we have a number of businesses that are located pretty far out and may not be near a recycling route of their current carrier. And I thought about somebody like in the metal business. We have people out in rural Minnesota that may operate in a pole shed, and they make things like railings and such. And I can think of one in my mind where the scrap metal goes into on a trailer. He puts it on his trailer because it's valuable to him, and when the trailer gets close to capacity, he takes it to the recycler, maybe down South St. Paul or wherever he goes to, maybe in western Minnesota, and recycles it. So in his business, that's basically, he's really saving everything, but everything's a value. And maybe he brings his pop cans home and throws them in the bin at home and actually takes them in for money and doesn't give them to his local hauler. I'm not sure what he does. But and maybe he's got 3-4 employees and they've got over a 2-cubic-yard bin for their garbage because they only get picked up every other week. So will he be required to put a recycling bin on his facility, even though currently he wouldn't have anything to put in it unless he decided to start throwing his pop cans in there instead of bringing them home?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, let me just address your first point. I agree with you. That's a good catch, and I think we'll look at amending. I'll talk with some of the other stakeholders, but I think that having what you talked about in 1.16, I noted that yesterday. I have notes about that. I circled that. I think that's something that's worth looking at in terms of amending the bill to have that the parentheses or the plural. In terms of your second question, I guess I'll defer to the PCA. We have some categories of businesses that are defined in the legislation, and I can't tell you offhand whether that case would fit into this.
I think we'll do the testifiers now. First is Carl Michaud, Director of Hennepin County Department of Environmental Services. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carl Michaud. I am employed by Hennepin County as Director of Environmental Services, and I manage, one of my responsibilities is to manage the solid waste and recycling programs in Hennepin County. I do have a very short, brief presentation I'd like to provide to you today. I'm here today to ask you for additional funding from the SCORE for Hennepin County's recycling programs. SCORE is funded by a tax on trash hauling and disposal services provided to business and residents. SCORE began in 1989 and currently taxes businesses at a rate of 17% and residents at a rate of 9.75%. The original purpose of SCORE was to provide a means to pay for recycling programs provided by counties and cities in the state. In fiscal year 2013, this tax raised about $70 million statewide. As you can see from the slide, $35 million is roughly going to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Another $21 million is diverted to the general fund. And you can see only $14 million roughly goes to the counties in the state, of which we get, Hennepin County gets $2.8 million. And of that $2.8, we pass 100% of that back to the cities for their curbside recycling and other organic recycling programs. This slide shows you what's happened over the years since the SCORE tax was implemented. You could see that roughly the counties are still getting the same $14 million over the last 20-some-odd years. Meanwhile, the revenues from this tax has increased quite a bit over the years, and that allows for more of the funding to the PCA and to the general fund. Hennepin County provides a significant amount of funding on its own for recycling and composting activities. We provide a lot of money to schools, businesses, nonprofits, and community organizations for recycling. Businesses are particularly important because in Hennepin County they produce probably 55% of all the trash that's generated. We provide a lot of recycling opportunities for household hazardous waste, electronics, mattresses. These are the things that we also operate two recycling centers where we have the people are able to drop off their paint, household hazardous waste, compact fluorescent light bulbs, and a variety of other things. And we provide a lot of other educational support and advertising and promotion of these recycling and composting programs to residents and businesses. One of the unique things we do is we have a master recycler program where we train individuals who become experts in this, and then they then in turn volunteer a lot of their time and effort to other organizations to promote and support recycling throughout the community. The county's been involved for a long time now, over 10 years here, in developing organics recycling programs. In 2003, we provided significant funding to the city of Wayzata, which was one of the first cities in the state here to offer curbside organics collection. In addition, we've done, there's a number of other cities in the county that have taken this up, the Maple Plain, Orono, St. Louis Park. There's many communities in the city of Minneapolis that now provide this service. So it's growing, and with additional funding, it would continue to grow. The other thing we've worked on is for public schools. We have 70% of the schools now composting or collecting all the organic and food waste from their cafeterias. And we have about 11% of the private schools. We provided some funding to many of the private schools in the county. We're trying to reach the last segment. Many of those are in the city of Minneapolis to get those schools to recycle and compost. And we started an extensive program to provide grants to businesses to start their organics program, too. And we were one of the first counties here to provide an option for anyone, any of the waste haulers operating in the county, to drop any organic waste that they might collect from a resident or a business at our transfer station in Brooklyn Park. And we provided that service at a discounted or subsidized rate. And that's been going on since roughly 2008. This slide shows the overall commitment by the county and the cities in Hennepin County to support recycling services. And you could see that of the $2.8 million, the cities and the counties are providing significantly more funding to meet the goals provided and mandated by the state. Hennepin County roughly contributes $9 million to this effort, and the cities throughout the county contribute about another $11 million. And this slide, again, I just wanted to emphasize that businesses are a significant generator of trash in the county, and we're trying to do our best here to reach out to many of those businesses to get them to recycle more and begin a lot of the organics recycling and composting. So with that, I hope you consider diverting as much of the funding from SCORE that's going to the general fund now back to the counties to implement our recycling and help us grow some of the organics recycling programs in the county.
Thank you. For the record, I have often stated that I thought we should take the money out of the general fund and put it into SCORE. But I think folks should know that the rates that we see were not all set in 1990. The SCORE rates were much lower then, and in the mid-90s, I think it was 95, we raised the rate substantially, and particularly the business rate, in order to pay for the landfill cleanup program. So that program has almost, that program is stabilized now. The landfills, the approximately 100 landfills, are now hopefully in stable condition. So there is an opportunity here that there wasn't before, but I think we need to be clear that the tax was raised substantially for the landfill cleanup program. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Machado, I'm curious. You showed a slide of, I think it was in a school, of three different bins. Are those the standard design in Hennepin County? Is that the same design used throughout the county and county schools, private business, those so that folks know?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara. In many cases, this is the standard design. This is the one most typically used. But again, depending upon the unique circumstances of the business or the school, there may be slightly larger or smaller containers located. This happens to be, I believe it's a school, and this was the best method for them to figure out how to separate the materials in that cafeteria.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mashad, is the design on there, is that the same one used, say, in the Hennepin County Government Center? So if a preschooler is in this facility when he comes to the Government Center, when he or she grows up and becomes a government employee, they'll notice those designs?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, well, we hope so. Our intent is to try to standardize some of the labeling and the pictures so that it's standard across the county. It's very difficult. There's still many organizations that want to have their own unique advertising or promotion. But we've taken the initiative and tried, Hennepin County has, and tried to make available all of these labels to these organizations so we have more standardization across the county.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mashad, they're not the same today as in the schools and the government center and everything. The containers and the labels are not, or they are?
They are.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? I don't see any other questions. Thank you. Trudy Richter, Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Trudy Richter, and I'm the administrator of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board. Commissioner Reinhart, Ramsey County Commissioner and Chair of the Joint Powers Board here in the metropolitan area, sends her regards, but it is out of Minnesota today on another National Association of Counties trip. I'm here to support Representative Hornstein's proposal. The coordinating board is a joint powers board, as I mentioned. It includes Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties. And you're receiving a two-page double-sided packet, the top page of which has our membership on it, where you'll probably recognize some of your county commissioners, those of you who are from the metropolitan area. There's two county board members on the board, and the PCA sits on it as ex officio, and we've worked for years in partnership and collaboration in order to increase the efficiency and effectiveness of our solid waste management system here in the metropolitan area. Our primary legislative goal is to increase SCORE funding, and the need is great, as Carl just demonstrated with how much is spent in Hennepin County, and I have some other figures to share today to all of you as well. We support the proposed bill, but we acknowledge that if this additional funding is available, and this we had hoped for more funding than we recognize your target is able to allow us, there will be a much greater opportunity for the coordinating board and our counties to increase and meet these recycling goals. However, without significant increased funding, it will be very difficult. I'd like to start with the second page of the handout. This is to reinforce again what Mr. Mashad said as it relates to what happens with current SCORE grant funds. I think it's helpful to see how it's currently distributed, how the graph in the middle of the page demonstrates that, as Carl said, the SCORE grants have stayed constant even though the revenues have increased. And our original hope through today's proposal would be that 50% of what's raised to the solid waste tax, those revenues, could be spent on SCORE grants. And that effectively combined what is currently going into the general fund with what we're currently receiving. Also, you'll note that in addition to the monies that the counties get through SCORE, the metro, all counties, sorry, in the state of Minnesota spend another $5 to $50 million total on recycling activities. In the metropolitan counties, that the coordinating board represents, most of the SCORE dollars go directly to the cities. 84% of the SCORE dollars in Ramsey County do, 100% of those, as Carl said, in Hennepin, 100% of SCORE dollars received by Anoka County also are distributed to municipalities. And overall, with the six counties in our board, 76% is passed directly through as grants to municipalities in order to do their programming. We'd also like to comment how important commercial recycling is to achieving the goal. As you may know, commercial recycling represents over 50% of the recycling opportunity that exists, at least here in the metropolitan counties. And if commercial recycling does not occur, there is absolutely no way the counties can meet the new goals. Now, we acknowledge that the Chamber has a wonderful subsidiary known as WasteWise, which is available to advise businesses on recycling. And the coordinating board counties have contracted with and are funding WasteWise to help increase business recycling. Haulers seem to be supportive of a mandate because when it is a competitive marketplace, they have told us that they will only offer what the business wants in order to remain cost competitive and keep that customer. So without the mandate, it's not going to automatically happen, recycling in our businesses. And in fact, in 2013, the board did commission an economic study to learn more about other jurisdictions and commercial recycling. And these economists recommended that a commercial mandate is one of the only ways to obtain higher recycling rates. We would support single-sort recycling for businesses, so fixing the container language is a good idea, one for recycling, one for the organics out of businesses. And we hope to work very hard with the additional dollars and the commercial recycling requirements that are in this bill to have a fighting chance to meet the new goals. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't see any questions. Next will be Terry Freithammer. Welcome.
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Freihammer. And before I begin my prepared testimony, I just want to address a question that came up earlier regarding distribution of the funding. Association of Minnesota Counties had discussions with the Pollution Control Agency, and they determined that the language in the existing statute will proportionally increase the grants across all counties. Again, my name is Troy Freihammer. I work in the Environmental Services Department at Stearns County. I am also the president of the Solid Waste Administrators Association, or SWA, and affiliate of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you regarding House File 2564 on behalf of both associations I mentioned. Since 1971, Minnesota statute states it is in the public interest that counties conduct solid waste management programs. How counties conduct those management programs is outlined in the Waste Management Act Statute 115A. This may be accomplished through reduction in waste toxicity, reduction in indiscriminate disposal of waste, as well as the recovery of materials. This is all part of the waste hierarchy, which governs all waste disposal in the state. Working with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, counties draft and adopt solid waste management plans that look at past management and potential trends to establish waste diversion goals consistent with the waste hierarchy and specific to the county. Like other counties in the state, Stearns County made the commitment and investment into its own programs, the programs of other local units of governments, as well as provided assistance to private businesses to make investment in diversion of waste from landfills to a higher level on the state's waste hierarchy. As stated by previous testifiers, SCORE grants to counties have totaled about $14 million and have remained relatively unchanged through today. Over that same period, waste generation has trended upward, the composition of waste has changed, and the regulatory environment very different. To meet their statutory obligations, counties spent an additional $47 million for SCORE-related projects in 2012. This is 13 times greater than the 25% required match of $3.5 million. As is true with many counties, Stearns County has had to prioritize the use of its SCORE grant. New projects or waste streams have not been taken on, grants to businesses have discontinued, and grants to other local units of government made more competitive. So I appreciate Representative Hornstein for introducing this bill and is supportive of an increase to the SCORE grants that will proportionally increase grants to all counties around the state. Counties have and continue to work hard to meet the mandates set in statute to promote the public's safety, health, welfare, and productive capacity of its population. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any questions. Thank you. We're also, Rita Saylor, would you like to testify? We will have additional public comment. Come up, please. And I have had a note that Doug Carnival would like to testify, and if anybody else in the audience would like to testify, this, you will be welcome. Particularly welcome to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm very pleased to be able to be here today representing the Recycling Association of Minnesota. I am the Executive Director of Policy and Outreach for RAM and testifying on their behalf today. RAM is a nonprofit organization committed to promoting resource conservation, recycling, waste prevention, and purchasing practices through the most cost-effective and environmentally sound methods available in Minnesota. The Recycling Association has more than 250 members from the public, private, and nonprofit sectors, including manufacturers, local government, educational organizations, and pretty much all of the solid waste professionals in recycling throughout the state of Minnesota. We'd certainly like to thank Chair Wagenius and members of this committee for giving us this opportunity to come before you today. We also want to thank the bill's author, Representative Hornstein, for bringing this really important legislation forward. And in particular, RAM would like to voice its very strong support for the provisions in the bill that return the revenues generated from the solid waste management tax to the original intent of working to improve recycling and waste reduction within the state. As many other testifiers have mentioned in the past and in this committee, as waste composition has changed, you know, everything changes as we move forward, and there are many new issues that have to be addressed by counties with regard to recycling, and increasing SCORE funding to the counties is probably one of the most singularly helpful things that could occur. And we recognize that these funding increases are of critical importance to Minnesota counties and the recycling communities with whom they work as they struggle to meet the current recycling goals, never mind any new goals. And so if Minnesota is to be successful in moving off of what, you know, some term as a plateau in terms of recycling rates, this increase in SCORE funding is truly crucial. We also appreciate the fact that this bill recognizes that one size does not fit all in the state the size of Minnesota, and rural counties and metro counties often have different you know, issues and need to have flexibility within the system. So I just wanted to be sure that Recycling Association of Minnesota was able to weigh in for the record and say that we are particularly in support of the SCORE funding and stand for questions. Thank you.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, Saylor, how many nonprofit recycling centers are there?
Madam Chair and Representative, I couldn't tell you exactly how many nonprofit recycling centers there are because those are not something that's necessarily reported. When I was, you know, it's very possible that there would be a nonprofit organization in a city or a county or just, you know, somewhere locally that would be doing some things with recycling. But I don't have a specific number on a nonprofit that does a recycling center as such. There are many entities that are involved, and it has a very broad scope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we wouldn't have an awareness of how much the administrative costs were to a nonprofit. Do you have any idea?
Madam Chair, member, no, since I don't know a specific nonprofit, I couldn't speak to that. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
I see no other questions. Thank you. Thanks for coming. Doug Carnival.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doug Carnival, representing the National Waste and Recycling Association, formerly known as the National Solid Waste Management Association. And we're here to say that we support the spirit of Representative Hornstein's bill. The recycling industry in Minnesota in the private sector has been very much out front on recycling over the years. It's a very important function that we perform in the state. In fact, we've been pioneers in the single-sort recycling efforts that many of you have spoken about today. Representative Hornstein mentioned the experience in Minneapolis, which just implemented single-sort. The recycling rate in Minneapolis has increased by 60% since that has occurred. St. Paul is about to roll it out as well. We now have 60% to recycling across the state in the single-sort manner, and we're hoping to move that up to 100% as this phenomenon takes hold across the state. We've invested much money and lots of innovation over the years in recycling, and we'll continue to do so as we move forward. We're in agreement with many of the provisions of the bill. We agree on the changes with respect to the definition of recycling to include source-separated composting. The source reduction goals are things we agree with as well. We support the idea of requirement for commercial recycling. We have for quite a few years and think that is an important step forward. We especially support, which is relevant to this committee, the redirection of monies from the general fund to the environment fund to increase recycling grants to the counties. Over the years, that solid waste tax, which was implemented as an aggregation of the sales tax on solid waste collection and other taxes on waste, has been diverted from the environment fund to the general fund, and we support returning that to the general fund, especially for recycling efforts. We don't oppose the goals with respect to increased recycling. We think they're rather ambitious, especially the ones dealing with composting, but this industry is ready to help and move forward in any way we can to increase recycling across the state. Happy to take any questions, Madam Chair, and happy to be here.
It is my memory, and you may know better than I do, that when the original SCORE tax was implemented, it was a bargain, and the bargain was that part of it was for solid waste and part of it was to go into the general fund.
Madam Chair, I don't recall. I was here as you were back then, but I don't recall if that was the case or whether it was all intended to go to the environment fund. I just don't recall.
Pretty sure that it was a grand bargain. It was Peter McLaughlin's bill. And
I remember the debate on the floor that shut the House down at midnight over that very same issue.
Yes, I don't usually like to relive history that much, but I do think we need to be clear on the record about how the monies have gone. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to say a word about this bill? Concentrating on the finances.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representatives. Good morning. My name is Susan Hubbard, and I'm here representing Eureka Recycling. We're a 501c3 environmental organization, and we're located in the Twin Cities. We've been operating for 15 years, and our mission is to demonstrate that waste is completely preventable. So we are here, obviously, today to support this file and to thank the authors for presenting this bill. Eureka Recycling has over 150 employees advocating, educating, and promoting recycling, but we also do recycling and composting, collection services, and we process recycling at our materials recovery facility. More than 20 years ago, the legislature addressed goals, and they haven't addressed goals for recycling since then, and we've never had a goal for composting in the state of Minnesota. And so this is really landmark legislation, and we're very excited to be here today to testify in favor of it. I wanted to mention also that while there is the money that the recycling programs generate is not enough to cover the cost of the recycling programs, that Eureka Recycling has returned over $7 million back to the communities we serve from the sale of those materials. And right now, there's over 1 million tons of the recyclables that are going into the landfills and incinerators that have a value in terms of that material being sold, as well as in job creation. Job creation in Minnesota right now from recycling is 36,000 jobs from recycling. If we were able to get the recycling out of the landfills, we could create more jobs today. And composting creates quite a few jobs, too. The thing about composting that's really interesting, that's different from recycling, is while recycling can be shipped all over the country and all over the world, composting is a very local phenomena. So the jobs that it creates are very local, and the money generated from composting stays local. Right now, we know that over a third of what we're throwing away is compostable. And while a lot of people are concerned about the ick factor, I guess, of composting, the surveys that have been done locally show that over 73% of the people in the metro area here are in support of having a curbside composting program, and many of them are already composting in their backyard. And nationally, the surveys with the numbers are similarly. 77% of Americans say they understand the importance of implementing a composting, curbside composting program. And 68% of those people who do not compost already via their own backyard or community program said they are willing to pay for a compost program. And this is on a national level. So this is very well understood that in order to reach any of our goals and to get off the point that we're at right now where we have been for over 10 years, we're going to have to do something about composting, and that is going to take resources. So how do we pay for this? And that goes back to the SCORE funds. And I don't know what the commitments were with the SCORE funds, but certainly today I think everybody's excited about the possibility that these SCORE funds could be redirected to helping to get this compost out of the waste stream and into soils and back on farms in Minnesota where it belongs. I just wanted to say one last thing before we close here with our testimony, is that in addition to actual collection services and driving trucks around, what the SCORE money has been used for also in great part is education. And the potential with educating people about preventing food waste in one neighborhood that we did last year was that we were able to demonstrate that a home could save $96 a month when they had the education and information about how to prevent the food from being wasted. So food they're buying at the grocery store and then accidentally by storing it the wrong way or by overbuying or whatever causes that food to be wasted, we were able to show that that food waste could be prevented and save them $96 a month, which certainly offsets a great portion of any costs of a curbside composting program. But we can't do that kind of education on the dollars that we have today. It takes a significant one-on-one training in order to get people to understand that. The last thing I'll say is about commercial and business recycling. I think what can be confusing is that when we talk about commercial and business recycling, we're also talking a lot about a lot of people's homes, because people live in apartment buildings. We call them multifamily buildings. And those are generally considered to be businesses because those are owned by companies often or by individuals and considered businesses. So right now today in the metro area, many people are not offered recycling services unless that business or that company is willing to pay for that service. They're not automatically included in the city's recycling program. So it's critical when we address the commercial business part of this bill that we do not forget that we're also talking about Minnesota residents that have been clamoring for recycling services for years and really struggling because they live in apartments and not in single-family homes. So once again, I want to thank you for considering these visionary goals.
Thank
and I'm
you.
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Keel, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, you mentioned you had 150 employees for your nonprofit. What is your source of funding?
We provide recycling and composting collection services, and we also process recycling materials in our material recovery facility.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair, I have a question of Representative Hornstein. The testifier brought up the fact that apartment buildings, businesses need to provide more recycling. I'm wondering, would there be a way to set up a loan program for small businesses to from the SCORE funds in order to provide these services for businesses?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Keel. I am not familiar that there's with the precedent for doing that with SCORE funds, in terms of what you're talking about, some kind of a revolving loan. I haven't heard of that. We haven't really considered that. But I don't think we have the resources right now to do something like that, although it's a good idea, and hopefully at some point it could be implemented. But I think right now our vision is to just simply add more money to the SCORE program, and hopefully the counties and others can come up with some innovative ways to do exactly what you're saying, which is a good idea.
Okay. Thank you. I don't see. Did you?
I can wait if you want me to. I have one more question.
No, I think wrapping up. This will be the last question.
Okay. Just an experience I had this winter. I was with my sister-in-law in Florida, and they because of the heat and the bugs, have to wash all their garbage. They clean everything up. And I find it real interesting when, recycling is fine and good, but I'm wondering, just a goofy thought, but if you have to wash everything when I'm on the farm. I don't worry so much about garbage and bugs. But when you have a larger population, how do you manage to take care of rodents and bugs and all of that with organics, with so much more of that garbage there? And then if we need to clean a lot of items, which I know people do, that we rinse out things all the time, how much water usage are we doing to recycle this stuff?
I'll quickly respond at least to the first one. Maybe Susan can do the second one, or Ms. Hubbard. On the issue of this came up. I've heard this argument in the past, but you're taking organics and putting them in the trash anyway. So for example, in our curbside program in Minneapolis, in my neighborhood, we're taking the organics, putting it in the same kind of it's an actually organic friendly bag. It looks plastic, but it's a compostable bag, and so you're putting it in that bag, and then you're putting it in a bin. So that's not going to increase. I mean, that's really you're essentially doing the same thing you're doing with your mixed waste. You're just putting it in a separate container. It's bagged, and it's in a what looks like a garbage container, but it's a compost container. So there's really no issue at all with sanitary questions related to that. In terms of washing recyclables, I think Ms. Hubbard might be able to quickly answer that one.
I'm happy to answer that, Representative. We try to educate people about what actually that means to wash recyclables, but there are several life cycle analyses of, to rinse a recyclable to the point that it needs to be, and the life cycle analysis of that versus throwing it in the trash. And by far, rinsing it and recycling it and saving that resource rather than having to go and pull another resource is definitely saving more energy. But I think you're right that that's part of the education effort, is that certainly to what extent do we have to wash things? And some people might still think you have to remove the labels from the glass jars, and that's really not true. So it's really about being able to keep up with the education and communicate that to people. And that's really an important part of any recycling program.
Thank you all for this. I truly appreciate your coming, your education. We don't have possession of the bill. I cannot lay it over, but when it gets here, we will do that.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Members, the next bill on the agenda is mine. It's House File 3158, and I'm going to move that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the Environment Finance Omnibus Bill. If you will note the bill, it is, I think we've already had the testimony for it. It is just for grants to local units of government to initiate or expand programs to compost solid waste. So, and I can tell you members that it's this number that I will use for the omnibus bill. So. If anybody has any questions about it. Okay. The chair renews her motion that House File 3158 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. It's now been laid over. Next up on the agenda is we're going to skip Representative Hansen and go to Representative Benson for House File 2431.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity for us to hear this bill this morning. I didn't hear. Have you moved the bill, or shall I?
If you would move the bill for possible.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2431 for possible inclusion, and have former representative or Representative Dietrich here too, in case there are some questions. Hopefully, Madam Chair, this will be really quick. We needn't spend, I don't think, a lot of time on it. I do want to let the committee know that I am serving with Representative O'Driscoll and Ward and others on the commission, and we have been meeting regularly. And the original bill, which I'm sure many of you remember, passed the House with very, very wide bipartisan support, 104-26. But we became aware of a question having to do with some phraseology in the original bill, because as of July 1st, 2013, the governor was to appoint a director for the Permit School Trust Fund, and did not do so because of a question of language in the original bill, which had stated in Section 16A125 as appropriated by the legislature. And so the governor did not appoint a permanent trust fund director, but the DNR, using funds which had been supplied, did hire a director, and he has been working, but that procedure does not really fit the intent of the original law. And I'd just like to remind folks that the notion of a permanent trustee, the purpose of a trustee, goes really back to the Middle Ages, probably to the time of the Crusades, really, when a knight or the king or others would go on crusade. They would turn over to a trustee complete control of their possessions, and the trustee's job was to have total and complete loyalty to that trust responsibility. And there's been debate and discussion, of course, for a long time about whether or not the DNR, because of the many multiple requirements they have to meet legislation, can be totally loyal to the children of the state of Minnesota in the school trust fund. I think it's unnecessary for the legislature to put the DNR in such a situation. We should make it clear that that the DNR is attempting to do good work. The DNR is attempting to meet the requirements of being a trustee of the school trust lands, but they also are being directed by the legislature to do a multiplicity of other things that sometimes can infringe on their responsibility for the children of the state of Minnesota. So the purpose of this legislation, Madam Chair and members, is to clear up the ambiguity that apparently the governor's office and the DNR felt encumbered the legislation from before. So this legislation is very simple. It simply clarifies that issue. And if there are additional questions, either I or Representative Dietrich, and everyone remembers how hard Representative Dietrich has worked on these issues all these years. I also have to compliment Representative O'Driscoll. We voted for him to be the chair, our chair, representing the co-chair, actually representing the School Trust Funds Commission. He's been doing an excellent job, and he strongly supports this legislation as well. Madam Chair?
I don't see any questions. Are there people in the audience who would like to testify for, or against, or comment? Bob Meyer is here from the DNR.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I'm just going to be very brief, as we have had this discussion with the Permanent School Trust Fund Advisory Committee as well. Well, we don't oppose the funding or straighten out the funding piece. I think people do understand we have some concerns about creating this duplicate position in our mind within a department administration. Our preference would be to create this position or have those duties transferred to the Department of Natural Resources, where Aaron Vandalindi, our trust lands director, would probably assume most of those duties. And we want to work with the stakeholders to try to achieve that, Madam Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meyer, you were there when this was agreed to, and it was your administration that you're part of agreed to do it this way. Have you a bill to change this, what you're suggesting now? This is different than what was agreed to between Governor Dayton and the legislature to set it up this way, and Governor Dayton's not following when he didn't recommend funding these positions. You're suggesting a change in that legislation. Are you saying that now the administration wants to change and move these positions to the DNR, and do you have a proposed bill for that movement?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I do not have any proposed language right now. You'll see the fiscal note on this bill actually outlines costs of about $524,000 that would come out of the trust primarily from forestry receipts. I don't have the actual split of the revenues that are out there right now, but probably 90% of the revenue that has come in to date to the trust fund, at least in the past decade or so, is from minerals activities. So we're precluding a large source of funding by straightening out this language from the suspense account. And we have had costs within the administration about our concerns of the duplicative nature of these two positions and how the positions would work together and what is in the best interest of the trust. But we have no language right now. That's why I said that we want to work with stakeholders to try to relieve this issue, solve this problem, I should say.
Well, the alternative, of course, would be to move the staffer now in DNR to the Department of Administration, which would be another way to handle it rather than having a duplication of effort. Am I missing something here?
Madam Chair, yes, but that person would still, in our opinion, need to work on a daily basis, on a regular basis within the DNR, within the DNR staff. So there's just some efficiencies that we feel could be gained by transferring those authorities.
Representative McNamara.
Mr. Meyer, this is going back on a deal that was made. And I understand the legislature has changed, but I'm sorry, the impetus were not Republicans to do this. Even though it was under a Republican legislature that did this, this was led by a suburban Democrat member and a long-serving Iron Range Democrat member that actually knew this issue very well. And we were willing to help them in a little way make this happen. Neither one of those members are here today, and it's absolutely unfair to the Democrats in the legislature now, including the governor, to not do what they're supposed to do. You can have an honest discussion of whether they should be DNR employees or admin. Mr. Vandalin is doing an unbelievably great job today, but we're not following the law. I actually don't know how, but I believe I got paid $66 to attend a meeting this summer from the Permanent School Trust Advisory that I'm on. I don't think that the governor funded one penny. I don't know where that money came from, but I don't think check bounced. We're not following the law, and we should either change the law or follow the law, and it says they're supposed to be in the Department of Admin. I don't have a dog in the fight where they go, but we should be funding this properly. And as far as it being out of forestry, you and I know more than 90% of the DNR costs certified against the school trust are forestry costs, because that's the reality. Doesn't take much to take the iron ore out of the ground on that one little boom that they did, and it was $1 million going into the school trust. Doesn't take much for Mr. Vadas and Miss Lewis, when they negotiated that deal, they probably charged the state a couple grand to negotiate millions of dollars going in the trust. Your forestry people on the ground costs us a lot of money. We get that. So, we can work out where the money comes from, but not doing it is wrong. And it was a deal made, and it wasn't made by Republicans. This was a deal where the Republicans helped two Democratic legislators that had their heart and soul in this deal, and doggone it, it's not right to abandon it now. It's not right, and it's not political. It's throwing Democrats under the bus, if you ask me. I just was along for the ride because I think they were right in their issue. And doggone it, we shouldn't, Madam Chair, you should fund this, and it's the right thing to do, and I don't care where it is, if it's admin or DNR, they're on the right track to put this. This was a mess that's really getting straightened out, and I think we should work on doing the right thing. Thank you.
Representative McNamara, if I'm remembering correctly, we did fund it correctly in our omnibus bill last year, and that's what went to the floor, and that's what passed the floor. But in conference committee, we lost, if my memory serves correctly. So we'll have one last comment, and then we'll, Representative Benson's going to lay this bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like Representative Dietrich to respond to a couple of those comments, and I greatly appreciate Representative McNamara's comments this morning.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every school board member in the state, which is over 2,000 school board members. And I just want to mention, I'm not going to go back and give you the historical context or the background of any of this, because we've had this discussion already, and actually there was a bill passed in 2012 that created a school trust lands director, and it was passed on a very bipartisan vote in both the House and the Senate, and it was agreed to by the governor, the DNR, and the legislature. And it was the intent of that legislation. There was never, I don't think, any doubt in anybody's mind what was the intent of that legislation, and that was to create a director position in the Department of Administration. But that has the time frame for the appointment has come and gone, and we are, the Minnesota School Boards Association has not lost track of this issue. And so last year we introduced a bill, Representative Newton introduced a bill to fund the position, and Chair Wagenius passed the bill out of her committee, put it in her conference committee report. It did not survive conference committee. So now the onus is on me, Madam Chair, in order to get the Senate on board. And I will continue to work on that.
Thank you.
And I would just like to make one last comment, that the Minnesota School Boards Association passed an almost unanimous resolution at their delegate assembly that stated that they urged the legislature to finally fund this position, and that if we don't feel like if it doesn't get done this year, this is truly a lost opportunity for the trust fund, the inheritance of the children in this state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a last comment. The trust fund now, and Mr. Vandalin has been doing a great job. We just want to make sure that his fiduciary responsibility is to the children, not to, the director of any other agency. And the fund, in the last 2 years, for all kinds of reasons, has increased dramatically from $650 million now to $1 billion. And over the two-year period, that means every single child in the state of Minnesota school receives approximately $60. And I remember when Governor Dayton was first serving, how hard it was for us to come up with $62 per kid. I think that was the number that we tried to get through. And this means as that fund continues to grow, that $60 per child every biennium will increase. And this is in perpetuity, forever. It'll never cost the taxpayers a penny. And we have an opportunity for this trust fund to grow dramatically in the next few years with good management. And this is something absolutely terrific. If you believe in the founding fathers of this country, this is something a bill you ought to support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to...
I would like to move...
That it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the time.
It has been laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and we're all grateful for the stock market. we have a couple things left on the agenda, which I suspect two will be very quickly that the 3187 is mine. This is exactly what we passed in the omnibus bill last year and wasn't funded. And then the Dill shooting bill, which was Hansen's and now Dill's. The B bill is going to be worked on in Ag this afternoon, and I know there is an amendment that is being worked on for that, a delete all amendment that's being worked on for that, so it's not appropriate for us to do an informational hearing. All the other informational hearings have been on things that have been processed through another committee. They just haven't arrived here. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I asked earlier about the possibility of floor session didn't go long. It's my hope that it goes extremely short. That's probably everybody's is being. We're getting close to the end of the week. Madam Chair, would it be possible that we just come back tonight 15 minutes after the end of session with the hope that session is short and maybe we would be able to be here in the afternoon and get people on the road while it's still light out?
We are. I am not adjourning. We are
I was worried, Madam Chair, we might come back at 6, and I'm suggesting maybe we come back 15 minutes after session.
If I will check and make sure if we have a room, I will do that. Right now we have a room available at 6, but if I could get a room available earlier, I'd be glad to do that if session is short. So we will be recessing. I'd be glad to do it earlier, I think. Can we do that? We will check, though. Rooms are scarce right now. You know that.
So, Madam Chair, if I understand you correctly, assuming we can find a room so the public knows, the hope would be to come back 15 minutes or whatever you seem is reasonable after session. As if session gets done at 3:30, we wouldn't want to wait till 6. That's my point. So the public will know the intent of finding a room. We would come back as soon as possible or practical.
I would be agreeable to that if that is agreeable for members. Is that agreeable to members?
Yes.
Okay, that's agreeable to members. If session goes long, I would even like to come in if it were late, fairly late, to do the same thing. You know, 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock. I think we could be do it fairly quickly if that's because it's just financing things. If that's okay with members too, is that all right? I'm not gonna say a word in session, I promise you. So it goes as quickly as possible. Okay. Representative Falk is moving the minutes of...
Madam Chair, I'd move the approval of the minutes from the March 18th meeting.
Representative Falk has moved the minutes of March 18th meeting. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are adopted. We are in recess to the call of the chair. Folks, we will come back together. Off of recess, and we have first up House File 2802, Representative Hansen is just just sitting right there. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would ask that House File 2802 be removed from the agenda.
All right, we will remove House File 282 from the agenda. But you're now up there, and if you would do House File 2908.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In House File 2908, we're doing an informational hearing, so I would ask members to look at what was adopted in the Ag Policy Committee earlier today, the DE5 amendment. That has the policy, the finance portions of this are that we would be providing for the establishment of the pollinator emergency response team with $100,000 in general fund dollars, and then $150,000 for a cap of $150,000 from the pesticide regulatory account for reimbursement for documented claims of bee deaths from pesticides. And I would ask Mr. Cruz from the department to come down if there are any questions of how the finances would work.
I think you could vary, since not everybody is on agriculture policy, if you could just give us a quick synopsis of what the bill does, not too many sentences, before we get to the finances.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, just maybe in some context, for the last few days I've been working with a variety of the interests involved in this issue, and we came to a compromise that is reflected in the DE5 amendment, and I think there are folks here who could attest to that and the department's support of the bill. What the bill does is it sets up a response and reimbursement and restitution relating to bees, and in doing that, it also restores some definitions that were stricken from statute in, I believe, 2002, defining bees, because up to this time we did not have any, or we had lost those definitions of bee owner, or colony and hive. So the DE5 amendment, you have definitions being put into 18B, Section 7 on Page 2, you have pesticides' impact on the environment and the establishment of a pollinator emergency response team. Section 8 is how the compensation would work, and this is what we worked on the mechanics of with the interest and making sure that we were explicit of how this would work. And then the forms, claim form, determination, payments, that is similar to what was in the original bill. That's on page 3. Page 4, we've got the appropriation of $150,000, and also Section 9 has the definitions restoring those definitions that are essential for the implementation of the response, reimbursement, and restitution program. We, in Section 10, take the language from the Department of Ag's report about pollinator bank, and just designate the zoological garden as the official pollinator bank. And then on Section 11, we have a report back to the committees on the value of bees, hives, colonies, and apiaries and queen apiaries for the purposes of compensation. And then finally, Section 12 is the $100,000 fiscal year appropriation.
Thank you. Mr. Cruz?
Santo Cruz, the Department of Agriculture. Yes, we do support this bill. We think it's good policy. Representative Hansen has worked closely with us on crafting language to be something that is both, in our opinion, good policy and also a workable program for how MDA currently runs and its Chapter 18D authority. It also addresses the issue of pollinators, which the department has been in support of this session and sessions before, as well as addressing some of our recommendations for the pollinator report regarding the pollinator bank at the zoo. So thank you for this chance to support it.
Questions from members? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, I've talked to a few beekeepers over the weekend, and yeah, there's problems with bee mortality, but
it was difficult to blame it on any one cause. So how are we going to determine, in a case like this, the exact cause of a bee kill, and assess the blame to somebody?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I think we're really not assessing the blame. We're providing the science, and that's the purpose for the creation of an emergency response team, to draw the best available information and making a determination. And the determination could be that you cannot, maybe it was cold, maybe it was some other reason why the bees were killed, but you would have the best available folks to make that determination as to what the cause is. And then once that determination is made, if it is a pesticide, then you get into the clauses in the book on how that would work. So,
thanks again, Madam Chair. So what would trip the trigger in terms of having the people come out and make this determination, a major loss or any kind of a loss?
Madam Chair, if I may, and Representative, the trigger is a complaint system. So it doesn't put the onus on the Department of Agriculture to be out there monitoring the bees. Similarly, the corollary to that is that the beekeepers themselves aren't under necessarily any duty to be checking their bees at any certain period of time. However, if they find in their regular maintenance of their bees that there is a collapse or there are dying bees, they will put in a complaint, and then the commissioner may assemble a response team. That's probably something that will be done prior to the complaint system being set up, that will have local partners in the area that we think are in the best spots, and by here I'm talking geographically, to respond, because time is of the essence. And then once those bees are taken in, if the typically the bees need to be dying and not dead to be able to accurately assess whether or not what the cause of death was. Other times, if they're full of varroa mites, then it's very easy, but that wouldn't trigger this bill, because as you said, there are many causes that the beekeepers are aware of. This is just to address the pesticide issue. Okay.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for trying to address some of the concerns in this bill, but I still have some serious reservations about this bill and this approach to the problems we have in bee colonies. I guess first I'd like to ask representative from the department, is there anything in present law that prevents you from responding to these colony collapses at this time?
Madam Chair and Representative, I wouldn't say that it's an issue of being prevented. It's a good example would be the Minneapolis bee collapse. Quite frankly, just speaking honestly about how things happened, we had a great response to that particular collapse, but that was more of a happy accident of having the right resources in there at the right time. And what this bill tries to address is formalizing some of the things that happened in that response, so that in our outstate bee collapses, we're able to respond more quickly and we're prepared for it. So though there's no prevention, it's really a matter of just planning and being proactive for the future on these issues. The authority is currently there, but the complaint system isn't. But whenever we have someone call in with a complaint about their bees dying, we do respond as best we can. But there are, in fact, times, particularly in outstate Minnesota, where we'll get a call to go out and take a look at what's going on, and by that time the bees are all dead, and there's not really a way to determine the cause of death. So this does provide for better planning, in my mind.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm trying to see and hear what in this bill helps you improve your response. Can you point that out to me, please?
Well, the assembly of the, I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative, the assembly of the response team is something that we'll be working on. And there it's really identifying the people that would be best or have the expertise to address a real-time collapse, and partnering with them to be more effective at responding to these conditions.
Th- Thank you, Madam Chair. So do we plan on hiring new people to be on these response teams or train with new training? I don't get it.
Madam Chair and Representative, no, this would be utilizing the expertise that's already out there. And so there wouldn't be new FTEs at the department. This would be working with experts in the field that have a willingness and a readiness to respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the people are there. They have the expertise. There's nothing inhibiting you from doing this work now. In fact, you've done it successfully already. Going on to the rest of the bill, Representative Hansen, is there a parallel to this in some other species that we are protecting in this way or trying to respond to in this way?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, we have two examples. We have the wolf depredation account, where we have a fee on the deer licenses that goes into a fund to help compensate folks who've had losses for wolf kills, and also the elk depredation account, which deals with crop loss. So there's two methods there where we already have an existing precedent for depredation. And I want to go back to your previous question about why can't we do this now? Well, the University of Minnesota is a separate entity from the department, the state, as we know, as are different agencies. So they don't have to do this. They don't have to participate. And as Mr. Cruz mentioned, this is a happy accident that it occurred. So this formalizes that, and the $100,000 provides for compensation for those costs incurred by other entities that are not in the chain of command of employees with the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How do you decide when someone has, if you're going to try and identify someone who has misapplied a pesticide, who's going to make that determination as to who's done a misapplication? And if there's more than one person involved, I mean, say it's, you know, there's a lot of spraying going on in a neighborhood sometime, how are you going to, you're going to go after everybody? It's a little unclear.
Madam Chair and Representative, the process for investigating and triggering this and trying to find out who the culprit may be is really identical to our authority under 18D. And there we're looking at whether or not they're using the pesticide. Well, first we're looking whether or not they're registered, using a registered pesticide. Then we're looking whether or not they're a structural or licensed applicator. And then we're looking at whether or not underneath those two buckets we have people who are using the pesticide per the label. If you're doing those three things, this bill does not implicate you whatsoever. And that's similar to how it works with crop overspray. Those are the same three things that the department would look at and investigate. And so you had asked about who would make that determination. The same people who make those determinations, ultimately it goes to the commissioner. Recommendations are made from the different members. In this case, it would be our pesticide and fertilizer management division. But the process is one that's intact and the same for other areas of 18D.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if we're talking about label, you know, misapplication, unlicensed application, or off-label applications, what prevents the commissioner from doing this work now?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, there's no method of compensation, the loss for the bees. So this provides for somebody could be applying under the way the bill is written, could be applying the pesticide properly, but you still have a taking of property of the bee owner. So there's no compensation. They're out of luck if you can't determine the responsible party. So this provides a resource to cover that loss if you can determine the proof that it was a pesticide, but you cannot determine the proof of who did it.
And Madam Chair, if I may, Representative, again, this is where you find the parity again with the wolf depredation account or the elk fund, where we're talking about, to some degree, nobody's broken any laws. You know, the wolf is what would be called in civil law an act of God. The elks may be there may have been some fault if they were, you know, not properly fenced or something like that, but through no fault of anybody's, they still may have had a fence blow down and had this happen. So it's really to account for the loss in those situations where you don't have a bad actor, but you have certainly a bad outcome that someone suffered from through no fault of their own.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So if lightning strikes my hog barn and my hogs die, I have a loss. And if I'm not insured, I have a serious loss. Mm-hmm. People have to protect themselves from risk. That's what we in agriculture do all the time. Mm-hmm. I just find this particular approach to be a bit of overreach on government's part. I think a lot of this work can be done with the current structure that we have in place. And with that, I'll end my questions, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if I could just respond. I think there are representatives from both Farm Bureau and Farmers Union, which have insurance programs, and they will tell you that they do not cover the loss of bees, the commercially available insurance. There is no system there. They cover the loss of hives.
Representative Anderson's next.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Carrying on kind of in that same vein, just trying to understand farmers' liability, cautiousness here. We had a bee person testify a couple of weeks back in a corn planting situation where, you know, there's no drift problems, there's no labeling as such as far as the insecticide on that seed corn. So if, in fact, there was a claim arising from that, explain how that would work.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think what you're referring to there is the systemic uptake through seed treatments. And there, this would not be seen as an application in the sense that that's something that you purchased your seeds through. So, for example, let's say I go and I buy corn, that seed-treated corn, and it's got a neonicotinoid in it or some other known pesticide. And the systemic uptake would result in the death of certain pollinators. Now, in that instance, one, there's a very low likelihood that you would have a colony collapse. You may have a certain amount, but studies are showing that the amount in nursery stock, and this would be your decorative flowers, can sometimes be 30 to 300 times more concentrated in it than in a soybean flower. So, one, we're talking about a very, very small sliver of possibility. But if that were the case, the person who bought the seed would not be the applicator. In fact, that seed would be regulated where in the home state of where that seed treatment took place, which in most cases that would be Iowa, quite frankly. So that would be, again, outside of this framework, and we would not be looking to, you know, track down everybody who's using treated seed because, quite frankly, that's a different can of worms, as they say.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. I think the example when the testifier was here was the dust from the actual planting operation that he said he had dead bees that afternoon that the corn was planted that morning. What about that situation?
Madam Chair and Representative, that would be different because they were talking about the talc powder. And I know that the industry is trying to address that situation by making the talc actually larger, physically larger, so that it will drop faster where it's supposed to. So that's a seed treatment that's done. It's called dust blow-off or blow-off. And that would be just like overspray for another application of a pesticide. So there we're talking about more apples to apples because that's something that the producer is introducing into the seed as it's doing an injection.
And Madam Chair, to help answer that, I mean, the commissioner, through his staff, would have to make that determination, and that's why you'd have I think if you remember the testimony from the applicator, they could not determine the proof. They could not prove that that was a neonicotinoid that provided that. So if you don't have that determination that you can back up with your regulatory system, you're not going to be getting a response. You have the science that goes out to respond it, so you make sure that your determination is the best available determination. And it may be likely that that shows there's no cause that would subject a reimbursement.
But again, just one follow-up. I think I got this from what you said, that if a farmer is planting corn and there's too much dust arising from this seed going in with the seed corn, that would be a misapplication from just too much dust in the process of planting corn.
Madam Chair and Representative, I apologize. That is not what I meant. What I meant was that the overspray would be similar, where that could actually cause, if that testifier was correct, that was what was killing the bees. So let's presume that it is. Let's say that the farmer's planting is corn, and you've got fine talc dust, and it's drifting over, and let's say it kills a bunch of bees. That would not necessarily qualify, and I, quite frankly, I don't think it would, but that determination remains to be made, as an application of a pesticide whatsoever, because you're not talking about a registered pesticide in a licensed situation. So I would need to follow up on that more, about the particulars of whether or not that would be considered an application of a pesticide. However, the physical transfer of a pesticide from one property to another would be similar. However, the determination always comes back to the Department of Agriculture, whether or not this person was a bad actor, basically going off label or any number of those things. And then when you're planting corn, I can't see them violating any law which would be necessary for them to be held at fault in this situation. So I didn't mean to insinuate that by planting corn you could somehow be breaking a law with regard to this particular bill.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, the DE-5 talks about willful and misapplication. When you are applying corn, you are not applying the pesticides, you are planting corn. The application occurred prior to the planting of the corn. The application was to the seed, so you are not applying a pesticide, therefore you're not having a misapplication.
Representative Dill, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen, someone said you said they insure the hive, which to me sounds like the house that the bees live in. My question is there business interruption insurance for something like this that a beekeeper could buy from an insurance company, that so that if their bees were killed inadvertently, can you buy business interruption insurance? For example, I'll give you an example. Recently, I had an outpost camp burned down because of a forest fire, and I had interruption insurance. And so the insurance company paid me for a period of time. It gave me time to rebuild. They pay me for the loss of the hive, which would be the outpost, but they also paid me a percentage of the income that I generated in the previous year from the outpost, which would be the hive in this instance, so that I could stay in business, get my cabin, my outpost rebuilt, and then continue on with the business. Is that something like that available? It may be crop insurance if you had crops, right?
Madam Chair, I would ask Farm Bureau, or we could have both Farm Bureau and Farmers Union will defer to Farm Bureau to come down, because we've been talking about this, and my answer was based, I don't know the answer to your direct question, because what we were talking about was the physical hive,
right,
before. So
as I said, there are two, Madam Chair, there are two components I'm asking about. Number one, you already answered that the hive is, that's my outpost camp, but then the lost income into the future for a period of time.
Madam Chair, for your record, I'm Doug Busselman. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Farm Bureau. And I don't know that I can answer specifically the question that's been asked, but I can, what I've been told in checking on what insurance that we have through our affiliate company that would be available, covers the beehive. It covers the liability for a landowner if someone should come on their property and have a bee issue. It covers the honey if there's a problem with the honey in terms of a product liability issue there. I don't know that it would cover necessarily if there would be a policy for business interruption or not. But the bill as it's written specifically talks about bees being insured. And there may be other companies that might have a bee insurance policy I know that our company affiliate does not have that type of insurance, but I was told that if there may be a new business burgeoning because of this. But for the record, when the bill was first introduced, we had significant concerns over what was. We had probably more concerns about what we didn't know than what was in the bill. And at that time, we made mention that we have we care about bees and are concerned about the liability issues that may be on farmers for bee loss. I think that Representative Hansen and the work that he's done working with us has been very helpful in resolving a lot of those unresolved issues. The version that you have before you now is a much improved bill. We appreciate having had the opportunity to interact, and we will continue to interact to bring about improvements where we can. Our biggest concern has always been the liability of someone, farmer, doing the right thing, following pesticide application requirements, and then being found guilty, if you will, of killing bees. This actually provides some protection in that the landowner or the farmer who is applying properly would not be found to be in violation. There would still be compensation for the bee owner.
Thank you. Are there Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen. Thank you, Mr. Busselman. It's not for you, the question. I don't think so. But Representative Hansen, I just have a question about the definitions. And I did ask a little bit of a question in ag policy, but it's maybe more on the placement of the definitions. We have in Section 1 on the first page the some definitions, and those are in Section 18B.01. When on page 4 on Section 9, it's in 19.70 definitions. And I'm just curious about why there are two different areas for the definitions. Would it not make sense to have the same definitions in both areas because they're not identical? It's just curious about how those were placed and the location in the statutes.
Madam Chair and Representative Poppy, the language or the definitions were in what used to be Chapter 19. That existed until 2002. In working with the department, this draft came from Mr. Cruz in terms of where to put them and the placement, particularly on page 1, of how those go into the chapter. I mentioned in your committee that we stripped out the administrative penalties and some of the rulemaking and that, so and tried to streamline it so that the chapter was within the authorities of 18D. I still wanted to have the Chapter 19 definitions in there because I think they provide the definitions that then are used in Section 11, where we use throughout the bill discussion of bee owners, bees, hives, apiaries, colonies, those type of things. So that was my intent. Mr. Cruz was the drafter, and it could maybe answer more specifically.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's correct. It was an intention to have those definitions live in two places. The difference is one that can be reconciled, and that may improve reconciliation of having the exact same terms. But the intention to have them live in both places was deliberate for exactly that reason.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, one, I'm trying to figure out, I know the fiscal implications are there's $100,000 to compensate for folks that lose bees. And how are you going to fund it? I'm thinking we're creating an expectation where if people lose bees, they're going to expect the Department of Ag, the university, and some other folks to get out here right away and do some inspection. This bill seems like it's really setting up some expectations, and we have a lot of problems out on the landscape with bees right now. this bill might be creating expectations, and I'm trying to, how is Department of Ag, what is the fiscal note for the additional FTEs to react to this? Because there's an expectation if somebody loses some bees, they're going to want them out there right away because they've heard there's a compensation fund that says they'd be compensated if the manner was consistent or if the manner was inconsistent. So I got a feeling they want their money no matter what happened, and they need the Department of Ag out here ASAP to just figure out what happened because they want their money.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, I would look on, actually the compensation fund is capped at $150,000, and the $100,000 is from the general fund for the emergency response team, so that's for reacting. And the, if you will look at the process, and I'm trying to find the component where that is, has a cap, I believe, of $20,000. And not less than 100.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so that helps. You do have $100,000 in there for additional costs, because I thought originally I heard the department say they were going to just incur those costs internally. You have $100,000 in there, and I'm assuming when the bill actually gets before us, we'll have the fiscal note that'll show that off. So that'll be helpful at that time. I'm also trying to figure out, it was interesting, the correlation. We're talking about an agricultural product here. And the correlation you made was to a couple of wild animals that we compensate people for because we've set up a system, and I'm trying to remember, the elk depredation account, I believe, is 100% paid for out of game and fish funds, where we've made a decision that the people that are participating in that would put some money in an account so that we could rationalize and expect producers to maybe incur some damage and we'd help them out. And I'm thinking that's what it is in the Gray Wolf account also. But this one's not that case. And so if we start with bees, are we going to chickens and pork and beef next? And where will horses come in? Because I really think... I'm very concerned about what's going on with bees, but I think you're really creating some false expectations here out on the landscape, and I don't know if you're realizing the implications of what you're doing, and I don't get the correlation to the wild. I'm trying to figure out the elk and gray wolf correlation to the bees, because that's a completely different thing, and I don't think that the precedent you're setting has never been, as far as I'm concerned, in Minnesota in agriculture. To compare it to a couple of wild animals that we've made a decision that we want to encourage and figure out a way to help people get compensated when they've been damaged by them, because otherwise we just go shoot them all. And we only got 100 elk. We wipe them out in no time quick. We tried to do that once already, and we, thank God, changed our ways. But where are we at in this correlation here? I'm trying to figure out with the wild animals.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, I've spent some time looking at, and you could Google bee law and look at English common law going back up to the 1600s, where bees are, that's where you started with domesticated or wild, and bees are in between. And so there's actually a common law that's been established over a period of time because we're not harnessing the bees. They don't have little harnesses on them. We control the hive, and there's precedent in common law about the ownership of the hive. The bee moves. You don't control it where it goes. So you have it essentially being wild when it leaves the hive, and you have the responsibility where it's there. And as you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I did look that up, and Mr. Cruz is, and could verify kind of that background, I think, as well.
Madam Chair, I am a lawyer, and I play one on television as well. To just address, that's a very fair question. My head was nodding the whole time because you're right. It is different in the sense that we're not talking about a wild animal. We're talking about a bee. I would say the correlation would be that the money that we're talking about that would compensate, it'd be restitution. It's not compensation. Those are actually terms of art in the legal world that have two very different meanings. Restitution comes from a fund that is tied to the pesticide account. And with the elk, you have it from the game and fish, and with the wolf, you have it from the licensing. So that's what I meant when I said you have precedent for having a fund that contributes dollars towards an area we're looking to protect loss. Now, the comment was made earlier about lightning in the barn. You know, to some degree, if you would take that to its logical end, you'd say, well, if people were out there using lightning on purpose for the benefit of their crops, we probably would have a fund for lightning. So there's the logical tension between if you're using something to benefit your land on purpose, like pesticides, that money goes into an account, and then those that would suffer from the use of that pesticides, making no claim about who necessarily is at fault. Certainly, if they are at fault, they should be held accountable, but that's more ancillary to what's being addressed here. What's being addressed here is saying we've got pesticides, which we all benefit from, which every time you open your refrigerator, you wouldn't have as much food there if it wasn't for these pesticides. However, through the policy that this body has created and legislatures before you, the wisdom has been that they bear part of the negative side of having that benefit as well by putting money into the pesticide account. And then this is seen as an absolutely fair move to take money from a pesticide account, capped at a certain level, because you're absolutely right. Expectations, you know, everybody's going to say my bees are worth $20,000, but that's why we have the provisions in here about finding a true valuation of these things, and that'll be in a report that we need to do our homework on, quite frankly. So you're drawing out real issues here that we're trying to account for. But at the end of the day, it's a matter of compensating the loss of the bees through really no one's fault other than this what could be an unintentional use of pesticides in an area that the farmer didn't even know the bees were at.
And Madam Chair, just to address the fiscal note, if you'll note the original bill, I had an appropriation of $200,000. Working with the department, they came back with the $100,000 general fund and the $150,000 at the pesticide regulatory account.
Representative Torkelson, do you have a question?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. On page 1 of the bill, 1.2, you define pollinators as an insect that pollinates flowers. And on page 2 of the bill, in subdivision 4, we talk about pollinators again, and the commissioner may take action. So is it your intention that if someone discovers dead pollinators out in the field, whether they be bees or not, just any kind of pollinator, that they could then call up this response team and have them come out and investigate the death of any pollinator?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, yes, they would be able to respond to a potential pollinator response, but that's why on line 2.1 you have the word may in there. So you've got the determination by the commissioner in terms of that response. In terms of reimbursement, there's no reimbursement for the native pollinator. There is for the bee, because you don't have the ownership of the bee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, but it just seems like that really is another reach in this bill, that you know, someone who's aware of this is out on a stroll and finds some dead insects, and they're calling up this rapid response team that's going to potentially need to respond, and perhaps rightly so, but perhaps it could get to be a little out of hand also.
Representative.
Madam Chair and Representative, you're absolutely right, and that's why we need that discretion, so that we don't have this kind of 911 response team. But really, I'd say the check on some of that is the valuation, because we need to have that discretion to, one, to be able to say whether or not this is something that we're going to actually spend those resources in sending out an investigation. And when that complaint comes in, if it does, of someone saying that there's a, you know, a wasp nest on their garage that they are concerned about, well, that's where we'll exercise our discretion accordingly.
Representative Packbar.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm still a little concerned about, could you tell me a little bit more about this pesticide regulatory account? Is that something that's already set up, it's already functioning? Has that got money in it now? Do we know how much money is in that account?
Madam Chair and Representative Hackbarth, I think it's sitting right around between $4 to $4.5 million right now.
That much money in that account now?
I think so. I can go find the exact amount. I believe it's public.
Well, Madam Chair, that's why I was interested in this, if this is going to cause an increase in fees or whatever is paying into this account to go up. It doesn't seem like if we're only going to put, $150,000 in this a year, I don't know that that's going to be enough to cover the claims. So I'm just not sure that this is thought out well enough to handle the situation.
Madam Chair, if I may, and Representative, we don't have this is an issue that has been growing, but we don't have so many of these that we think that $150,000 is a pittance. And the valuation of the bees as well, the $20,000 is really kind of I mean, it passes the smell test, but it would certainly be a rare, rare production, and you'd have to have some really amazing financial statements to show that you were reaching that level. You're certainly not talking about your hobby beekeeper. We don't have a lot of calls of this nature, but Representative McNamara is right. It will create an increased complaint, which is why we've made the request we have.
Representative Anderson and then Representative Keel.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. One of the things I've learned down here is we make a big deal out of the words may and shall, and you've talked about establishing this pollinator emergency response team, but the language says you may establish that. It also says you may include representatives of local, state, federal. If it says may, why doesn't it say must or shall? And do you want that latitude where you maybe don't have to do this at your discretion?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, this isn't going to be like Ghostbusters where they're sitting there waiting for the bell to ring. The may gives them the flexibility, depending on where folks are at, where the incident may occur, where they can reach the best available science that can respond to this. So that's why you'll see the may in there, because the team may be different depending on the location of the incident. And Mr. Cruz could elaborate.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's exactly right. If we were trying to name or delineate everybody that we may partner with in this, quite frankly, we don't know who all those players might be, and it would be different players depending upon the area of the state, or in some cases the nature of the complaint put forth. If it's an active hive that's in the process of dying, well, that's very different than one that is, you basically just have 60 sick bees in a pile. It requires different expertise, different equipment, and so that's why we want that discretion.
Representative Keel, did you have another question?
Thank you, ma'am. Just to follow up, but you also talked about having, as I recall, having this team kind of in place to get out there quickly and be ready as the bees are dying. So you're going to have some kind of a team assembled beforehand, correct?
Madam Chair and Representative, I wouldn't say assembled in the sense that Representative Hansen is right. They're not going to be sitting around the fire hall waiting for the bell to ring. But, no, you're absolutely right. They will have to be on notice that due to their geographic location or their area of expertise, that they have agreed to participate in a response if a complaint comes at a certain time or a certain place. And that is something that we're going to have to explore with the experts and the resources that are out there.
This will be my last one, Madam Chair. You mentioned the compensation and market value. You know, when an elk dies or a cow or something, there's a market, and you can kind of establish what that cow is worth. How do we establish what a bee is worth in terms of the compensation part?
Madam Chair and Representative, some of that I can answer right now fairly simply, and just what is their monetary benefit, because part of the language here mirrors that they have to be commercial bees, so you'd have financial statements like any other business. But your question is a very good one in that there are unknowns about how do you value a queen, so to speak, you know, because she's not producing the honey and things like that. And that's something that we need to produce a report by next January to this body to see if we have found the right formula and whether or not we have the right way to value those bees, because that you're putting your finger on a real issue that's been identified and that has been drafted into this bill, because that number needs to be known, or at least that methodology needs to be known beforehand.
Representative Gill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been in bee land all day because of bag policy. Anyway, and I might have asked this question already, but do we know how many colonies that we have in Minnesota?
Representative, or Madam Chair and Representative, I do not have that number. There's probably, I've been in bee land myself all day, and for the past 2 weeks, there's probably many people who've been at those hearings that are that would be much, much better to answer that question than myself. I do not have the numbers on how many hives we have out there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Hey, is there anyone in the audience who would like to say a word or make a comment? I don't see anyone. This bill has not been received in our committee yet. Hopefully it will be here tomorrow. So thank you, Representative Hansen, and thank you, Mr. Santo. Representative Dill isn't here right now. We will send for him. But while we're waiting, we can do my House File 3187. And I would move that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the Environment Finance Bill. I have an amendment and an amendment to the amendment. So let's adopt the amendment, if we will. I'm just simplifying the language that we actually used last year and passed last year when we were providing some dollars for Habitat. So I would move the DE1. Any questions? I don't see any. All those in favor of the DE1, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? DE1 is adopted. I'm going to simplify it even further by there is another an amendment that you have that just simplifies the language one more time, and I would like to move that amendment. I don't see any questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. I'm sorry. It was supposed to be an oral amendment. You all don't have this?
No.
Oh, then I'm sorry. I have it all nice and typed out here and thought we will do it as an oral amendment. So members on, and perhaps council would do the oral amendment for. You don't have it either. I'll do it. On line 1.5.
Is this on the D1, Madam Chair?
Yes, it's the D1 amendment we're amending. On line 1.5, before restoration, put habitat restoration, so the word habitat is inserted. And then on that same line, take out the words that increase pollinator habitat. So we're really just moving to more general habitat here, I is what I'm doing. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any objections? That oral amendment is adopted. Members, last year when we did our omnibus bill, we had $700,000 in it to go to DNR for the original bill that you have. And that was our language, and it was to create additional pollinator habitat for both wild and pollinators and honeybees. And that was not accepted in when we went to conference committee. We asked for a report from the Department of Agriculture, and they talked to us about how much habitat we were developing that was good, and that the numbers that came in were so small that I thought we might want to consider this again this year. So do you have any questions? Well, with that, anybody in the audience have any questions? With that, I will move that the House file 3182 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Environment Finance Bill. And I think the last thing we have is Representative Dill.
He's on his way down.
And he's on his way down. So we will wait for Representative Dill. And he has, let's see, where is it? He has 2780. I believe, and we will ask Representative Dill this. This passed in his committee, and I believe I saw it on the blue sheet that it was transferred on the floor to this committee. But we will ask him that when he gets here. Okay. So, is there anybody who would, is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify on this? They could start. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Michael Gerster. I'm a member of the Oakdale Gun Club. I can't speak to the whole bill or the whole state. I can only speak to our particular club, which is in the metro area. I explained yesterday that this year we were approached by five different schools for the trap programs, and it's the fastest growing sport in Minnesota. There's approximately 5,000 students that would like to get into the sport. We do not have the capacity to serve the kids, and this is what we're looking for. We sponsor one trap team. We offered it at night for another one. They decided that we were not big enough, and so they had to find someplace else. We would be more than happy to become involved in this grant program. We would be happy to establish another trap. A trap range by itself would probably cost about $75,000. We need to buy 10 more acres to be able to do it. And we would be more than happy to fund our portion of that to help the kids out. Sorry.
Representative Dill.
Did you move the bill, Madam Chair?
We have not moved the bill, and my question to you is, did we receive the bill on today?
I believe you did, and I noticed that the bill I have in the packet is not amended from last night, at least this version, so it may have come.
Okay.
You know, there were a variety of, the oral amendments had to do with the word trap being put in front of shooting, and then a Hansen Amendment and some other things. And this is not the bill that left my committee.
All right. Then I think we have just sent out for that. Is that true? Where did Mike go? We are getting that. So why don't you just give us a little bit of information, and if we could have it checked to make sure it did transfer to this committee. I believe it did.
Are you having someone do that?
No. I was hoping that your committee administrator would do
he's
that.
He's doing that right now. Okay. All right. First off, as Mr. Gerster said, this is the fastest growing sport. It is now. It went from the original vision of Jim Sable at 60 kids to 6,000 in only a couple of years. I mean, just phenomenal growth. These are kids with firearms in their hands, with their moms and their dads out at these shooting ranges. They're having fundraisers, pancake feeds, everything you can imagine to do this. There's even trap clubs that are being formed in schools that are 50 to 100 miles from trap ranges to go practice and raising the money as well. So I think this is extremely bipartisan. This is about possibly about a major component to keeping our game and fish and shooting safety and gun rights safe and growing. And I have yet to find one single person from the Speaker and the majority, the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader of the Senate on down, that has been opposed to something like this. I've been approached, as I know many members in this room have, about the critical nature of having the facilities to actually practice so they can prepare for events. This is not a metro problem. This is not a rural problem. This is a statewide problem in every town, whether you be in downtown St. Paul, who is absolutely at maximum capacity with the kids, whether it be at the Metro Gun Club up in Blaine, or whether it be in Thief River or in Worthington, everywhere. I just had Randy Voss come up to me at the Safari Club International event a week and a half ago, who has been in the business for many decades, and he has five high schools practicing at his Caribou Gun Club, and he said there's no possible way that he could keep up with that. So this establishes a grant program for trap shooting specifically. And it had, in the bill that I amended last night and that Representative Hansen amended to kind of get it technically right, it asked for a very modest, very, very modest, thank you, appropriation of just $100,000. And as you can see by the testimony by Mr. Gershner, $100,000 doesn't go that far. But it's to get a placeholder because of this gigantic increase in the sales of ammunition over the past years, including having 6,000 kids buying shotgun shells at Gander Mountain and at Cabela's and at their local hardware stores, so on and so forth. The Pittman-Robertson money is on a trajectory, and as well as the scare of ammunition being scarce, the Pittman-Robertson money is on an upslope like Lutzen Mountain, trying to climb it in the summer going up. And so that money is going to be available to fund this project in the future, and so I'm really optimistic. I just want to tell you that I've been participating in this sport since I was 13 years old, in organized sport with the Amateur Trap Shooting Association, and our family has traveled all over North America, and I've traveled all over the world doing this, and it's kept me out of trouble. you know.
We were with
to the extent that you can imagine that.
We were with you until that comment. Are there other people in the audience who would like to testify for or against?
And the bill did arrive.
Yes, I do see that we have it adopted. So, seeing no questions and no one... Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this forward. Up in my neck of the woods, we had a trap range that adults weren't using for 3 or 4 years, and then the students started in on this. We started with 3, and we went to 30, and this year we'll probably have, we could have upwards of 50, and for a small town, it's really exciting, and they're just having a lot of fun with this. It's a great idea.
Well, and also I want to I asked Representative Hansen if he'd let me chief author this bill because this has been a passion. I want to acknowledge the fact that he turned the bill over to me. This is a family thing. I mean, it's a family thing, and that's the reason I'm so happy to bring it forward, and I know it is widely bipartisanly supported.
Ooh, family thing. I'm now thinking of new bills for me.
There you go. Well, you're doing well at pollinators.
Representative Bly, I don't do pollinators.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Dilla, there was a club that contacted me perhaps a year ago that was interested in funding their trap shoot equipment and or improvements on it. And when I showed him this bill, he said, well, we're not a public club. Does that matter, or can you explain? I know it does say that they must be open to the public. Can you tell me, so if this were a private club that we're going to let high school kids come in and use it, they would have to open their trap shoot to the public. Is that correct?
It would. The purpose of the language that Representative Hansen put on the bill was there are clubs that are membership clubs.
Nice.
For example, Oakdale is a membership club, and I'm a member, and we go there. They are also open to the public on certain days and certain hours.
I see.
But if they take these funds, then it assures that they're going to be open to the public.
Okay.
And they are a nonprofit. But let's just, using the example of the Caribou Gun Club in Le Sueur, they are a for-profit business. If they take these funds, they would not be able to charge a membership fee to the students so that you could participate in the sport at that location. They would have to make that open to the public.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
I want to comment also on that because we are involved in the program. We are a nonprofit group, but we do open to the public. We start in June. We're open every weekend to the public. In October and November, we are open on a daily basis to the public. We probably put 12,000 members of the public through our ranges every single year. Not only on weekends, but we have, I run a novice trap program all summer long. And that's every evening on Wednesdays. I would say that somewhere between 40 and 60% of the people that come to that are non-members. They're people of the general public. And so we are open that way. We want to spread the sport. And you can only do that not with our membership, because we're limited on members, but we have to promote the sport by bringing in the general public.
Any other questions, members? I don't see any questions. Representative Dill moves that House File 2780 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. As far as I know, members, Representative Dill, it appears that House File 2564, the Representative Hornstein bill on solid waste, has not been transferred to this committee yet. Am I missing something here?
We transmitted the bill to the front desk. We are unaware of why it happened, and when we called over there, we weren't able to get any information, but it was sent from our committee to the front desk, and at the very least, in the morning, first thing, we'll assure that it's on the blue sheet on tomorrow's business. All the other bills, including this one, got listed on the blue sheet, on the committee reports, but that one, for some reason, didn't. It's my full intention to have it here tonight.
So, members, is there anything else for us? Well, at this point, Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and just on topics, there was a bill, and Representative Benson had a bill previous year, and we've heard a bill in Representative Dill's committee on narrow leaf cattails and hybridized cattails. And I'd intended to put in a bill to be having the DNR provide us with Dill's committee on narrow leaf cattails and hybridized cattails. And I'd intended to put in a bill to be having the DNR provide us with some recommendations on this, because I anticipate we're going to continue to be getting individual bills on this. I talked with Representative McNamara earlier. I would intend to do an amendment, just letting people know on that. Talked with the agency about that on cost, just to prepare us with some recommendations for next year's legislature, because these individual bills are probably going to keep coming. So
it is the chair's intention. I mean, we are working on having this bill posted as soon as we can, but as you know, staff is working hard and very busy, but certainly it will be in time for folks to do amendments, including Representative Hansen's amendment, and we will meet again. We won't meet tomorrow. Are you cheering? We won't meet tomorrow. We will meet on Tuesday at 8:15. We will meet at our regular time. We will then recess for an evening meeting, and we will, we're not dealing with a lot of money here, so we should be able to finish up in the evening. I think people do not want to do this on Thursday evening, and besides, our deadline is Wednesday. So with that, any questions before we look for the omnibus bill to be posted? And with that, we will adjourn.